or 12. I went 12 seasons.
All right. Live in about 15 seconds, so give it. Just have to wait for the sounder to stop playing.
I will follow your lead.
All right, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. As always, my name is Matthew Blittner. To my right is a special new guest co-host, Andrew Gross. Most of you may know him as the Newsday Islanders beat writer. And in case you didn't catch our theme song, written by Jessica Page Damari, whose full works are accessible online at jdcompositions.com, this is the one and only Outside the Studio. So for the next 59 minutes, please sit back, relax, enjoy some hot and cold sports takes. And in case any of you are wondering, I know we joked on the show that Daniel's going to be thrown off the show. That's not the case. Him and Walt are both out of town this week, so they couldn't be here for the show. But rest assured, they will be back. This is not a Wally Pipp situation, as much as I like to joke with him that it is. Andrew, welcome. How does it feel to be here? And, you know, Islander fans are really excited that you're going to be on the show today.
Well, we'll see where they are after 59 minutes. But no, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. This truly is outside the studio, isn't it?
Absolutely. And for those of you who are wondering why we're laughing, it was a journey to get to our new studio today. We really have taken the show outside of the studio. So we're going to get started with the craziness that was this week in New York for hockey. And I'm more specifically talking about the New York Rangers. Andrew, I know you and I both cover the Islanders bit more than we do the Rangers, but how the heck did this week happen? Lou, it Monday, Tom Wilson ragdolls Panarin and essentially commits a felonious assault against Pavel Buchnevich. Doesn't get suspended, gets a $5,000 fine, though. Okay, George Parros, if you're out there listening, great call on your part. That news comes out Tuesday. Rangers release a statement Tuesday evening, roughly, that is among the most pointed you'll ever see against a National Hockey League executive.
Yeah, they were apoplectic. Absolutely apoplectic. They were furious that it was only 5,000, no suspension. And you know what? And we can debate this all you want, whether Jim Dolan wrote that personally.
There's no way.
Yeah. But he certainly was behind that, and they knew they were going to get fined, and they wound up getting fined $250,000, and they don't care.
They don't. Look, he can afford it. If anyone can afford $250,000, first of all, any National Hockey League owner should be able to afford a $250,000 fine. Not to say that they should make a habit of being fined that way, but it's not going to hurt any of them in the wallet too much.
What was shocking about it is the Rangers, strangely enough, under Jim Dolan, considering, you know, how the Knicks have been under his ownership, you know, for the past 20 years, the Rangers had almost been a sort of a, you know, a model of consistency and calmness and, you know, good management, you know, for the past, you know, really 10 seasons or so.
Well, you know, it was only a matter of time as fans and writers from across the sports, basketball and hockey, have weighed in saying that it was really just a matter of time before Dolan did maybe not this, but something to insert himself into the Rangers. Normally, look, I was around the team for 4 or 5 seasons in that locker room. I think I saw him twice. He congratulated Mika Zibanejad after a big game. He congratulated Artemi Panarin at one point. And I think I saw one other time. That's it. The guy was not around, really.
I was actually surprised. One of the Islander Ranger games at the Garden this season, I actually saw him come up to the press box level, which I was shocked at. You know, I turned over. I was like, there's Jim Dolan. That's kind of odd. But, you know, the one thing... I guess, you know, there's a lot of things, if you're a Rangers fan, that's upsetting about this. One, you don't know, you know, what the mandate now is from Jim Dolan towards Chris Drury as to what the,
We're getting ahead of ourselves right there for a minute.
My point is, probably the upsetting thing is... This is, you know, Chris Drury was going to get a job in the NHL. He deserved a job in the NHL. He's going to be a good NHL GM. And it just stinks for him that these are the circumstances where he gets this job, you know, and he doesn't. Now, I'm not saying he's got, you know, JD and Jeff Gorton's blood on his hands, because that's not the case at all. And he praised both of them, you know, especially Jeff Gorton. But the optics of this just, it doesn't look great. You know, you fire two very competent and much more than competent NHL executives, two proven, you know, leaders, and for Drew to get his first job like this, it kind of stinks for him.
It does, and for those of you who, you know, I put this on Twitter the other day, if you've been living under a rock, let me catch you up to speed a little bit. After the Rangers put out the statement, roughly, I want to say it was probably about 16, 17 hours later, they announced that they fired GM Jeff Gorton and team president John Davidson. That was enough of a shocker that the sports world, essentially, forget the hockey world, the sports world stood still Wednesday afternoon. That was seen as so far out of left field that everyone thought it had to have something to do with the letter. There was Frank Cervalli, he, you know, with TSN, he was saying that, you know, sources said that they were thinking that Gorton and Davidson tried to distance themselves from that letter. There, you know, there was that whole issue. There were people, executives across the league, who thought, look, there has to be something going on. There has to be some sort of connection. It has to be part of the reason. It doesn't have to be the whole reason. It has to be part of the reason. Lo and behold, look, maybe we're getting the full truth. Maybe we're not right now. The answer is probably somewhere in the middle of that. But it looks like James Dolan was just really annoyed at how the team did not make the playoffs this year. He went on record saying that the team has underachieved, which I don't know how a team can underachieve in year three of a rebuild.
Not when they're that young. I mean, you know, I think it's more with the construction of the team, really. And how they're playing. And also, I don't think David Quinn has done himself any favors by continually saying he wants his team to play a different way.
Especially since Strome and Zibanejad and Panarin seem to be especially against that in the postgame. Strome has come out said it, not in so many words, but he doesn't like it that Quinn says that.
The Rangers play a pretty game. And
well, it's only pretty if they're winning. When they're losing, I don't know that's such a pretty game.
Well, and pretty is not always the nicest adjective in hockey either. But by pretty, I mean... They skate very nicely, and they go side to side, but they don't, you know, you watch teams like the Bruins and the Caps and, you know, even the Penguins and the Islanders, the playoff teams in the East Division, they skate towards the net. Even when Matthew Barzal is at his freewheeling best, the Islanders are more of a straight line team than the Rangers are. And, you know, and I think that's where some of the disconnect happens between David Quinn and his players, in that, you know, David Quinn wants them to be more of a straight line team, but Mika Zibanejad and, you know, Buchnevich and guys like that, you know, Lafreniere, they're skaters and they're not disciplined skaters. And that sort of is on the coach to make them disciplined. And that's why I sort of question David Quinn's future with the organization.
Yeah, and look, it's the square peg round hole theory there. And you mentioned Barzal and the Islanders being more of a straight line team than the Rangers. And it's ironic that you should mention that, because it was the two disastrous performances against the Islanders and the one Tom Wilson Red Darling game with the Capitals that basically pushed Dolan over the edge. And, you know, word is that he consulted with Glenn Sather about the move. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. Sather seems to have some influence still, as you can see, that he's going to be guarding Chris Drury along. And then the funny thing is, for all the Rangers' east-west moves and their pretty passing, they went out Wednesday night, and you could see right from the face-off, it was a coordinated thing, a la John Tortorella against the Devils in 2012.
Yep.
They went out, threw pretty out the window, dropped the gloves in a full-on line brawl. Literally, the only thing missing was the defense getting into a brawl, but Zdeno Chara, you saw, basically said, you guys don't want to come after me. Yeah. And so then that escalated into Brendan Smith, 50 seconds later, jumping Tom Wilson and somehow picking up the instigator penalty, which your former colleague and, you know, our mutual connection in Rick Carpinello has always pointed out how the instigator rules on the penalty books, but it never gets called. In this situation, it got called.
Yeah.
And then you had Michael Roffel and
Strome.
Strome went after Strome went after Law Zeller.
Right.
And Roffel and Boteto. There were six fights in the first 414 of the game, which is an NHL record.
And that was an odd one, because Roffel was actually taking the faceoff, and Boteto skated into the faceoff circle as the faceoff was being dropped.
They wanted their pound of flesh, and you know what? They got it. Tom Wilson got taken out of the game by a quote-unquote upper body injury. Well, you know, we know what that's told for. He didn't really, you know, I'd be hardly surprised if he actually had a real injury that was debilitating enough to keep him out of that game.
Yeah.
And the Capitals knew they had to somehow try to find a way to get the game under control, which TJ Oshie did. He went out, had a very emotional hat trick in honor of his father who passed away.
At a very young age, he was 56.
Right, so that's, yeah. You know, oh, kudos to Oshie for, you know, coming through on that. Obviously, that's not going to get talked about a lot. From a New York perspective, you know, Pavel Buchnevich in the second period actually cross-checked Anthony Mantha, and lo and behold, George Parros actually found the rule book and suspended him for a game. So, Parros, under what circumstance does a vicious but, you know, still not unseen cross-check warrant the one-game suspension, but near murder warrants no suspension?
Yeah. You know what? Buchnevich would have done himself more of a favor if he had just confronted Mantha when Mantha, you know, there was the initial hit, and then Mantha was, you know, hitting him on the back of the leg saying, let's go, let's go, let's go. And Buchnevich kept skating the other way. And then Pavel decided he wanted some of Mantha. So, you know, Pavel probably should have just turned around and dropped the gloves, and he wouldn't have been suspended, I think.
Who knows with the way that the rule book is being applied at this point for this. And then the lead fines them $250,000, which is 50 times more than what Tom Wilson got fined. It's $150,000 more than the San Jose Sharks got fined for a lesser statement about 8-9 years ago, in the playoffs. Where's the rule book here?
Well, how about this? If you're comparing fines, Matthew Barzal just got fined $2,000 for diving. That's only $3,000 less than for what Wilson got.
Hold on. If you really want to get crazy here, you might recall a couple of years ago, Henrik Lundqvist squirted Sidney Crosby in the face with a water bottle and was fined $5,000.
Yeah,
so squirting someone in the face with a water bottle cost you $5,000. And again, near murder on the ice also costs you $5,000. I'd love to know. I wish some judge or lawyer called into the show right now to say, by the way, this is how that legally makes sense, because it doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, yeah. This is off topic, but years ago when I was in high school, I don't know.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's not as long as you might think.
So you used to have train passes, right, to get on, you know, the train. Yeah, for free if you were a high school student, right?
They still do that for the bus.
Okay, so I after school, I stopped off at a friend's house, played some touch football, and then tried to use my train pass after 5 p.m. to get back home, and a cop gave me a ticket for illegally using my train pass. So I actually had to show up in New York City court one day.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I went, my dad my dad brought me, and we went down to, you know, City Hall or, you know, Lower Manhattan. We sat through this court case, and they were bringing people up three at a time, right? So there were two kids, you know, a little bit older than me, both on either side of me. The kid on my right goes up to the judge. He was in for drug possession, right? He got fined $20.
Okay. Probably the cost of the drugs that he had on
him. Yeah, right. They bring me up to the judge. Oh, you were using your train pass illegally? $20. And then they brought the kid on my left side up. Same deal. It was a drug charge. $20. So we're walking home, and my dad said, "So, son, did you learn anything out of this?" I said, "Yeah, I should have been doing drugs."
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we hope that you're not doing drugs on this, but that really does equate very much to this. And, you know, I know George Parros has said that, you know, he used precedent for things. You should have gotten in touch with him and told him that story to see what the precedent is for the National Hockey League, because I think he would have... Maybe he would have listened to that, and maybe Wednesday could have been avoided.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, no, I didn't start using drugs, and my dad was, you know, he looked at me, he was like, "You're kidding, right, son?" I was like, "Yeah, but you get the point. I mean, it's like, you know, why should I be paying that much money for a silly crime?"
And look, if you're going to do the time, if you're going to do the crime, do the time. Yeah. But in this case, the time and the crime don't match up. So that is, honestly, I know I opened the show by saying that it wasn't going to be a Wally Pipp situation.
Yeah.
And for Daniel and Walt, I'm getting responses from fans all over social media right now. Guys, I think you might have been Wally Pipped at this point alone. But we still have 45 minutes to go.
I still got 45 minutes to screw this up.
So. I don't see the screw up happening. So we clearly have touched everything that's gone on with the Rangers now. And we will get to the Islanders, which is a team that, of course, matters in terms of the hopes of the city and the hopes of New York for a possible Stanley Cup parade. We'll get to them a little bit later on in the show, as we're going to be joined by Arthur Staple of The Athletic.
Looking forward to that.
We're going to have the two biggest... I'm sorry, Brian. I know if Brian Thompson is out there listening, I'm sorry that I'm not including you in the two biggest comment, but we're going to have the two biggest Islander beat writers on the show to do an Islanders roundtable, so we'll get to that about 4:40.
Arthur might be, you know, when you say big with Arthur, he's been covering the team for a long, long time. I feel when you say big with me, it's more of a heavy joke. So
it's not, I can assure you of that. But in the meantime, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to go through all the things New York sports related, and we're going to get kick-started with the New York Jets and New York Giants as a recap for what they did last week in the draft. I know we generally like to try to keep things up to date, and what's more up to date than getting some fresh opinions on who won this draft situation? Andrew, we're going to get started with the Jets here. Mm. We know they took Zach Wilson, second overall pick, quarterback out of BYU. So far, you can't really complain because he hasn't been on the field yet in a game where it's going to matter and where you know whether it's a good or bad decision. However, I do have to say this. The early comparisons from fans and some writers across the industry claiming that he is going to be as good as Patrick Mahomes. Now look, I hope, as a Jets fan, I hope he is as good as Patrick Mahomes. I hope he's better. But for a guy who's not thrown a professional pass to say that he is equal to Patrick Mahomes at this point is blasphemy. In fact, I'm going to borrow from Toppenolo again and say, it's asinine.
You know, at this point, you have to hope that Zach Wilson is as good as Sam Darnold. Never mind Patrick Mahomes.
I think if he's as good as Sam Darnold, there might be some fans burning down Jets drive.
But what I'm saying is, if he's not as good as Sam Darnold, then they really screwed up here. So you have to start at that baseline. If he, you know, the comparisons to Patrick Mahomes come, you know, probably because everyone saw on YouTube that one across the body pass that he made, right, during his pro day. And he does have that ability, that innate ability to get a ball out, and he's got a powerful arm. And that's where those comparisons come.
But anyone can make that type of a throw on a pro day. If you put you or me out there, we could make that throw on a pro day.
You might. No, my arm would fall off. But
I don't know about that.
But you know, the point is, you know, Zach Wilson is going to have to, first of all, he's doing better than Sam Darnold, because we all think he's got a competent coach coaching him up here.
Right? Who, by the way, forgot that he was the head coach yesterday when he would address the media. But that's besides the point.
That's fine. But, you know, I don't think, you know, and look, I'm a bleeding green Jets fan. I have always been. And it's, you know, one of the worst things that's ever happened to me in my life. And I'll be honest, I was not sold on having to trade Sam Darnold and draft Zach Wilson, because I don't like having to start over every 3 years. And I get the financial implications. And look, you know, the Panthers just re-upped Sam Darnold, and it's costing him, was it, $22 million? And
something like that.
Right. So I get the financial, you know, implications, and the fact that Joe Douglas and Robert Saleh want to start over, you know, reset the financial clock. And I was reading a piece, I forget where it was, a week ago, wondering whether this is the new paradigm in the NFL, whether teams are going to frequently reset their quarterback salary cap hit by drafting young guys. And
you'll never have another Peyton Manning, Tom Brady, Drew Brees, or Aaron Rodgers ever again if that happens.
But quarterback prices are getting out of hand.
Then the GMs should learn to depress the market a little bit and stop bidding against each other so much. I know it's called collusion in baseball, went to court and lost in that a few decades ago, but still.
But the prices don't go down, the prices go up. And look, you know, if you're telling me Zach Wilson is Patrick Mahomes, I'll sign him at $50 million a year for the next 10 years. Give him $500 million for the next 10 years if he's going to be Patrick Mahomes, because Patrick Mahomes is that good. But look, the odds are that he is not going to be Patrick Mahomes, because, you know, you talk about generational talents. You talk about that in every sport. You know, a Connor McDavid, right? You know, that kind of player. You know, in football, we last heard that, you know, before Patrick Mahomes with Andrew Luck, you know, and that didn't work out so great for the Indianapolis Colts just because he couldn't stay healthy. But, I'm not convinced Zach Wilson is a generational talent. He's got a really, really good arm. I think, based on, you know, his kind of shallow resume, he thinks the game okay. But, you know, what makes Patrick Mahomes special is really how he thinks the game and how he's able to improvise and put it all together with the special arm that he has. And, you know, I don't think you can ask anyone to duplicate that.
No, you can't. And, you know, even Patrick Mahomes, at the peak of his powers, which we're going to assume he basically is right now, if he was on the Jets, they're still not a playoff team. Maybe at best, they're 8-8. So maybe that's good enough for the seventh and final spot now that everything's been expanded. But that's a big question mark. So you're going to say, you know, who's Wilson throwing to still? You know, I know that the Jets went out and they got a wide receiver in Elijah Moore from Ole Miss.
Yeah, should be a really good pick.
But they still need more wide receivers. They still need more running backs. I know they got Michael Carter. Yes, they actually chose, you know, two guys named Michael Carter within rounds of each other. The absurdity of that is beyond belief. But the first and foremost thing is, beyond the weapons, the actual best thing that they did was take their offensive tackle guard, Elijah Vera Tucker, in the first round.
Love the pick.
That in itself is going to help make the Jets better, because now they're starting to have a true offensive line that can protect the quarterback. And even if the quarterback doesn't have great guys to throw to, last I checked, Tom Brady for the 10 middle years that he was in New England, he didn't really have too many great guys to throw it to. He was so good that he made them better. And if Zach Wilson is capable of making guys better, then he needs the time in the pocket to throw. And that's where the line comes in.
Well, and, you know, it goes beyond that, because Vera Tucker, he's going to play left guard, right? He's going to play on the left side?
Probably. We don't have any definite confirmation.
But you think you're going to put him right next to Becton, right?
Absolutely.
And you know, you think those two, you know, fortify the left side for 7 to 10 years, right? But it is so crucial that they're playing on the left side because you're protecting Zach Wilson's blind side. And look, as a rookie, coaches are just going to eat him up with stunts and blitzes and all sorts of, you know, veiled coverages. And, you know, they're going to try and fool the rookie. And, it's going to be, he doesn't have a deep resume. So he's going to be learning on the fly in the NFL. The fact that his blind side is going to be well protected, we think, between Becton and Vera Tucker, is going to be crucial to his development. It's going to give him that extra quarter of a second. He's not going to develop happy feet because he's constantly getting hit from behind. And, I think that was an issue with Sam Darnold was,
He was seeing ghosts. He
didn't sense the pressure well enough, right? And I think that this pick will allow Wilson at least some time to kind of wade into the deep end a little bit better.
Well, he will hopefully have that time. One team that clearly is buying time is the New York Giants because not only did they make some picks, but they also made a number of trades down in the draft.
Trader Dave.
In order to, which by the way is a first because he's never done that with the Giants, in order to not only get some talent for this year, but to make sure that they had some good picks for next year. So it almost sends a mixed message. Are they going? They're clearly not going all in this year. They're clearly not going to say that there's any mandates for this season. And they're going to let things develop, especially with Daniel Jones. But I think they're setting themselves up with one eye on the future with the way that they made their trades.
You know when they're all in? When they send Daniel Jones and their next two or three first-round picks to the Green Bay Packers for Aaron Rodgers.
Then
you know they're all in.
Hey, Dan Rosen and Tom Stevenson, if you're out there listening right now, we'd like to comment from you guys. I know you're big Giants fans.
Yeah. Hey, no, honestly, I thought Dave Gettleman, and look, he's gotten a lot of, what's the word we can use on radio, dung? He's gotten a lot of dung.
Sure. Yeah. I don't hear my producer in our ear saying anything about that, so we can say that.
About the way he's, conducted business with the Giants since he's taken over. But I thought he did a masterful job in the draft. And if you ask me, who won the draft between the Jets and the Giants, I would have to say, more so the Giants just because the Jets didn't pick up a corner, right? And they really needed a cornerback. Now, you could say Dave Gettleman sort of ignored the offensive line, and for a guy who touts his hog mollies, it was very odd that he didn't add to an offensive line that, is down Kevin Zeitler and, really did need some help on the offensive line. But I just loved the value he got trading down. God knows what the Chicago Bears are doing, because
that's a question for a Chicago-based radio show.
But it doesn't work out with Mitchell Trubisky, right? So now they're going to take another swing and trade up again and get Justin Fields from Ohio State, who, look, some people think he's going to wind up a much better quarterback than Zach Wilson. And if that's the case, then, good on the Chicago Bears. But still, it's a big swing, right?
It is.
So I loved Gettleman trading back, still getting his, one of his targets in Kadarius Toney. And all you needed to know about Kadarius Toney is you've got Urban Meyer, crying that he's heartbroken that the Jaguars couldn't get this guy, And then what I really thought made the Giants draft was picking up Azeez Ojulari. And I'm awful at pronouncing
names. You came closer than I did on getting that right.
But, so we'll call him Azeez, right?
Sure.
Yeah. You pick him up at number 50, and he's the edge rusher that the Giants, everyone needs a star edge rusher, and this guy, really could be one out of Georgia, right? The question is arthritic knees, which is a condition he's had since high school. James Andrews, checked him out and said, hey, all good here. So if this guy plays to what his potential is, they got two guys in the, they got two big big-time first-round picks, you know, spread over two rounds, basically.
It didn't be something that's going to have people talking, especially as we get into August when training camps are expected to go back to maybe some sense of normalcy in the NFL. Right now, we're going to quickly hear from our, you know, the people who pay the bills over here, as I'll call them. So, ladies and gentlemen, please listen in for our commercial. And then coming out of that, Andrew and I are going to discuss the Mets and Yankees. So we'll be right back with this.
And now for a word from our sponsor, JOCO. JOCO is the most convenient, sustainable, and enjoyable way to commute around New York City. JOCO is an electric assist bike share program with 100 private locations across Manhattan, Brooklyn, and Queens.
Micromobility has grown significantly over the past year, and it's easy to see why. Most trips in New York are faster and more convenient on a bike than on the subway. And these bikes are electrically assisted. It takes much less effort, it's far easier on hills, and it's faster than a traditional bike.
JOCO bikes look sleek and trendy, are great for sustainability, and provide a slight or rigorous, if you want, workout. JOCO bikes are easy to use. All you need to do is download the app on the App Store or on Google Play and find a participating JOCO bike location.
Check out the website, RideJOCO, that's RideJOCO.com, and their Instagram account, at RideJOCO, for updates. So go out and ride a JOCO bike today. JOCO brings convenience and joy to your commute.
All right, Andrew, that was our commercial. I hope that's inspired people out there to go out and ride a JOCO bike today. There are electric assist bikes that are populating Manhattan right now and will soon be going to Brooklyn, Queens, and the other boroughs. But in terms of the other boroughs, we're going to get to, we'll start off with the Mets since I just mentioned Queens. Andrew, what are you seeing out of the Mets? They fired the hitting coaches, and I do mean hitting coaches, plural. They fired them in, it wasn't exactly a clandestine thing, but it almost seemed like it was the result of a joke that the players were making that they ended up getting fired.
Yeah, I think there's more to it than that. Although, Mike Puma, the Post, got Chili Davis on the phone, and Chili, you know, sort of laughed it off and said, but yeah, you know, that didn't help me at all, you know. But I still think they were going in a different direction. Chili is old school, and you know everyone wants to be cutting edge analytics right now, and that's just not how Chili plays, you know. So I think it was sort of fated that he was, you know, whether it was now at midseason or after the season. I don't think Chili Davis was long under this regime, but. You know, what am I seeing out of them? Well, you know, I'm seeing a team that just can't get a big hit. And it's frustrating as all heck. And, you know, it's a lot of the same. You know, Jacob DeGrom pitches brilliantly and he loses, you know, a 2-1 game or a 1-0 game. You know,
look, if those 1-0 or 2-1 games were, if half of them were converted into wins, we're talking about a guy who, and people already talked about him as being a surefire Hall of Famer. We're talking about a guy heading towards the record books.
Well, I was talking about this with my buddies, all who happen to be Mets fans the other days.
Sorry for them.
Yeah, that's me too. But, you know, is there a chance Jacob DeGrom goes into the Hall of Fame with fewer than 100 wins? Because it sort of feels like it.
In the Saban metrics era, it will happen.
Yeah.
If Felix Hernandez can win a Cy Young at 13-12, then the shackles are off. Anything can happen.
Yeah, you know what? And you look at wins and losses, right? And I know it's a devalued stat, but it still does tell you part of the story here. I mean, look at the Yankees. Gerrit Cole, you know, we're going to agree that Gerrit Cole and Jacob DeGrom are probably 1-2. You know, probably DeGrom on top, but the two best pitchers in baseball.
1A, 1B.
Right. They're two best pitchers in baseball right now. Gerrit Cole is 4-1. And Jacob DeGrom is what, 1-2, 2-2?
Something like that.
Yeah, it just feels like he should be 7-0. But, you know, look, it's funny. It's so easy with the Mets to think all gloom and doom. But, you know, like take yesterday's game in St. Louis, right? They walked, what was it, 11 or 13 times. They left 16, you know, runners on base. You know,
at least they were getting runners on base, right? Which is an improvement.
I mean, it was, you know, they got four runs. They probably should have had eight or nine. But, if you listen to the game or if you read the stories after the game, you would have thought they lost, right? But they actually won in St. Louis. They come home. They're 13-13. And you got to think. Yeah, I think the expectations for the Mets are you win this division because the Braves have also gotten off to a slow start. I don't believe in the Nationals. I don't necessarily believe in the Phillies, right? So I really think it comes down to the Mets and the Braves in this division. And I look at the Mets, and they should win this division. They have the hitting there. They certainly have the pitching.
And they'll be getting reinforcements over the summer.
Yeah,
from guys coming back from the injured list.
And you know what? I'm not even excited about DeGrom. I'm excited about Taijuan Walker. I'm excited about David Peterson. You know what I'm seeing out of those guys. You know, and even Marcus Stroman. I mean, you got Noah Syndergaard. Knock on wood. Hopefully coming back July, maybe August. You're going to have a deep rotation, and you have to think that still matters in Major League Baseball, no matter how much they've screwed up this game.
Absolutely. And look, in terms of screwing up the game, which is going to be a fine segue for this, the Yankees this week faced the Astros for the first time since the Aroldis Chapman giving up Jose Altuve, or Altuve's home run, as Peter Rosenberg deemed him on the Michael Kay show the other day. And it was the chance for the Yankee Stadium fans to let the Astros have it after the Astros got off in a Tom Wilson-like stop-free situation from Major League Baseball for their cheating. And boy, did Yankee fans can be some of the most up-and-down people in the world, myself included, and they let the Astros and Altuve and Bregman and they let them have it.
Yeah,
that was a game that probably could have gone either way. That they let them have it. I've never been so proud of the new stadium. The old stadium would have been completely different. You would have had no questions. Yeah. The new stadium has not lived up to the old stadium in terms of how the fans react. And yes, part of that is the exorbitant ticket prices and having too many corporate suits sitting there.
Yeah.
But they let them have it where 10,000 because of the COVID restrictions sounded like 70,000. That was awesome.
Yeah, no, that was a good day. And, you know, often things in sports, you build it up in your mind and it never kind of reaches the expectations you think are going to happen. And, you know, and we saw two examples of, you know, you mentioned the Ranger, you know, the Ranger Capital game with the line brawl to start. And that sort of lived up to what you thought it was going to be, although a lot of it was manufactured. But the best example really was that game at the stadium where the fans really became the story of the game. And, you know, you mentioned about everyone getting off scot-free. It's amazing to me that really the only person who has managed to have sustainable punishment out of that is Carlos Beltran.
Yeah, that.
I mean, go figure that. AJ Hinch is back in, right?
Alex Cora's back in.
Everyone's back, but Carlos Beltran. He's the guy, right?
Look, and you wonder how that's going to affect Beltran's Hall of Fame chances. He probably will get some, you know, he'll have to wait till the ninth year on the ballot type of thing before people forgive him. Or they might treat him like Pete Rose for crying out loud and say, no, you're not coming back into this.
Yeah.
And, you know, it really is just absolutely amazing. I saw on Twitter the other day that there was a fan who made a race to the bottom for the most hated commissioners in professional sports, in the four sports. And, you know, a lot of people always say Roger Goodell is the most hated. Honestly, after this week, and just over the few years, Rob Manfred and Gary Bettman are giving him one heck of a run for his money. You know, I don't know what Adam Silver's doing over the NBA, that he's somehow avoiding most of the wrath of the fans. Not to say that he's been perfect, but all of a sudden, Bettman and Manfred are giving Goodell, the king of the hatred, a run for his money, and I never thought I'd say that in my life.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, you know, when I talk about baseball, I just seem to age myself because I really just dislike the direction they've taken baseball. You know, it's, you know, either a home run or a strikeout, that's not fun for me.
Or a walk. Let's give the same metrics people right. that do.
Or a walk. And look, you know, I could care less what the exit velo is. You know, if the ball gets over the wall, the ball gets over the wall. You know, so, you know, and the shift, you know, and I thought it was great. In the Yankee game the other day, there were actually a couple of guys who went and hit against the shift, right? And you eliminate the shift the moment more players do that. So I was happy to see that.
And it really is something that, look, I myself am happy about that too. I think that the over-reliance on pulling the ball is just completely doing away with the strength of the game and the beauty of the game. Ladies and gentlemen, we are now going to go into the one thing that our fans have been looking forward to the most, as what I've been told for this show. We're doing a roundtable with two of the best, I'm not going to use the word biggest, Andrew, two of the best
Thank you.
Islanders beat writers covering the team today, and that is Arthur Staple of The Athletic and, of course, my co-host here today, Andrew Gross with Newsday. And I guess we can count the fact that I'm the Islander beat writer for the New York Extra. So I'm going to call Arthur, and ladies and gentlemen, let's get ready for what is sure to be a great roundtable.
It's actually a rectangle table.
Sure.
Hello.
Hi, Arthur. It's Matt and Andrew here at Outside the Studio. How are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you guys doing?
Good. Thanks for joining us here for this very special Islanders roundtable. And look, guys, before we get into the most recent results for the Islanders, I'd be remiss to not say that, yes, the playoffs are coming, so we don't know exactly when the last game will be, but tomorrow is going to be, for real this time, the last home game at Nassau Coliseum of the regular season.
Well, unless...
And so what are you two, you know, what are some of your fondest memories for the two of you with this?
I just want to throw out, unless UBS, you know, their targeted opening in November is closer to Thanksgiving, because you can't have the Islanders play a month on the road next season. So I'll believe it when it actually, we're actually kicked out for good.
Well,
as far as since it's this last scheduled game,
yeah,
we already went through this in 2015 also. But for me, you know, covering the Islanders for the last decade, not a ton of playoff games played there. I would say probably game three in 2013 when they made a surprise playoff appearance after the shortened season, when they had a pretty big run to get in and were the eighth seed and weren't expected to do very much. And that game was an afternoon game, and it was completely bonkers from the minute that I pulled into the parking lot, which is pretty early in the morning for, I think, a noon start. And it just was crazy the whole time. You know, I think you hear Barry Trotz when he talks about 2015, how crazy it was when John Tavares scored that OT winner in game three. 2013, I think, talking to some guys who were on the Penguins, same thing. It's just... it's a special place to be in the playoffs, and it's gotten more special because they just haven't seen so many playoff games over the last decade or two.
Yeah, that's a good one. I'm thinking, you know, and obviously Arthur's been on the beat a lot longer than me, but, you know.
Not way to date him on this.
Well, no. I mean, I was covering other teams, but, you know, I've been covering games in that building back to January 2003. I think it was my first Ranger Islander game covering there. I had just gotten on the beat. And in those days, you actually had to watch, you know, the pregame warmups because there were border wars. People would get into it in the pregame. And I was up in the press box in the little, you know, media meal area up there, standing next to Glenn Sather watching the warm-ups, and all hell broke loose. And Arthur, maybe you can remember who threw the first punch on that one. It was, I think that was the one game Brian Trottier coached for the Rangers back at the building, the 5-0 win for the Rangers. And I'm standing next to Glenn Sather, and there's all hell breaking loose, and there's no refs on the ice, and Glenn is just going nuts, and he whips out his cell phone, and he's yelling at Colin Campbell on the cell phone, "Are you watching what's happening here?" That to me was funny. I also think back, I guess it was Barry Trotz's first season, and they had just sort of gotten back into the Coliseum. And it happened a few times, but after the games, we would have, the post-game interviews downstairs, and the fans would be filing out through that, concourse area downstairs, and they were chanting loudly for Barry Trotz, and the whole thing just bled into the post-game interview session. And, I think Barry was both a little embarrassed, and also I think it really fed his ego a little bit.
Well, maybe it did. He seems to not have much of an ego. He is a very even-keeled coach, Barry Trotz, although the Islanders probably testing his blood pressure a little bit this past week, actually even more than a week, really. They've only had two regulation wins in probably the last 5 weeks. Arthur, get us kickstart here a little bit. The Islanders, we know they're making the playoffs. They obviously clinched. They have the Eps next to their name in the standings. But what is a reasonable expectation for this team, considering how they've looked over this last month?
They're not going in, obviously, playing nearly as well as the other three playoff teams. I think we kind of said the same thing, even with the long delay last year. And obviously that worked out pretty well for them, even though it was a bit of a different format. Every time you kind of feel like a Barry Trotz coach team, especially here, and more importantly, a Lou Lamoriello run team, looks like they're on their last legs, they look like they're kind of stumbling to the finish line, they do seem to be able to put it together and have that ability to kind of rediscover their game. They won't have such a long layoff to be able to do that as they did last year going into these playoffs, obviously. But I wouldn't count on them being, wiped off the face of the playoffs by any of these other three teams. I think you just look at it, obviously, the Islanders are having the biggest problems on the ice, but there are some cracks with some other teams. The Penguins, both of their goalies are injured right now. I know they'll have time to get healthy. Washington seems to be in a little bit of disarray with Evgeny Kuznetsov and Ilya Samsonov on the COVID protocol list. Alex Ovechkin's been injured. So there's ways around it, and I think the main thing for the Islanders is, can they rediscover the way that they need to play? And they haven't done it consistently for a while against any team, really, except the Rangers for about the last month or so. But do you doubt that Barry Trotz and his coaching staff can find a way to get them back to that place? On the surface you do, but I think you still have to have a little bit of faith in their ability to draw the best that they can out of these guys.
And Arthur, I mean, watching these games, the one thing that has not fallen apart for them is the goaltending. And you mentioned Jarry and Pittsburgh and the Caps having goaltending issues. And, the fact that, especially Varlamov has kept his form, even with, the defensive structure in front of him, a lot looser than he's used to here, and Sorokin too. I would say the Islanders probably go into this 4-team East Division tournament with probably the strongest goaltending tandem going in, and I think that's always the biggest check mark you can have, next to your team name heading into the playoffs.
Yeah, I agree. Maybe you think the Bruins and Tuukka Rask, but it certainly doesn't look like right now they're going to be seeing the Bruins in the first round. So if it's Washington or it's Pittsburgh, obviously teams that have far greater firepower offensively than the Islanders. But if it's true that defense and goaltending is what wins you championships, or at least gets you far, the Islanders, you'd probably take their defense core and their goalies over the same crew on Washington or Pittsburgh. And that has to start them in a good spot. They have recent wins the last two playoffs over each of those teams. So if you're basing it on recent history this year, not so great a look for the Islanders. But if you're basing it on a big picture and overall the last couple years, the Islanders know how to get in both those teams' heads. They were real lopsided series wins over the Caps last year and over the Penguins 2 years ago. So they certainly know what it takes to beat both those teams. So that's another way to you really can't count them out.
Now, Arthur, you just talked about how their playoff experience is going to be a big thing for them. It's a big factor, as it is for most teams in the playoffs, that, you know, the more you've been there, done that, it almost becomes like muscle memory. You don't get intimidated by the moment. And with the Islanders for the second straight year struggling after the deadline, what is, or I should say who, because it's not a what, who is going to be the X factor, or needs to be the X factor, for the Islanders if they're going to come out of this malaise and make a similar or better type run that they did last year?
You know, I think it's, you hate to put more pressure on the guy, but I think it's Kyle Palmieri. You know, it was Jean-Gabriel Pageau who clearly was struggling with the burden of the trade and the new contract after he was acquired, had the long layoff, was able to kind of settle in, had a whole new training camp. So he had a lot of advantages that Kyle Palmieri doesn't have going into these playoffs. But Pageau was really the X factor for them last year in the playoffs. He scored their first playoff goal. He was really strong pretty much all the way throughout and kind of helped give some supporting offense to their core guys. Palmieri needs to do the same thing, and maybe even a little bit more because of the absence of Anders Lee. It's not a guarantee that he'll be playing on Matthew Barzal's wing in the playoffs, but he's got to provide some offense. And, you know, you can say that it's a little bit, he's on a real cold streak right now. I think he's shooting 3.8% or something like that. He's got a goal and maybe almost close to 60 shot attempts since he's gotten to the Islanders. And he's a much more consistent scorer and shooter throughout his career. So you have to think there'll be some regression for him, especially as we get towards the playoffs. But they just need to round out that top nine a little bit better. The offense is really the thing that's been hurting them the most in this funk that they've been in. And if he can kind of find a spot 5-on-5 and on the power play to produce, that's going to, I think, open some things up for some other guys and kind of provide what the Islanders were looking for when they traded for him.
I thought you were going to completely tweak the Islander fans and go with Leo Komarov there.
Hey, don't be knocking on to Leo.
Leo is Mr. Consistency, so I don't think there's any worries about what he's going to bring to the table.
But seriously, going into the playoffs, do you think Barry goes into the playoffs with Leo Komarov on Barzy's left wing along with Jordan Eberle? Does he dare do that?
I mean, there's no chance to me that Leo Komarov is not in the lineup for game one of this, any of these series. I think not only for the kind of the consistency and predictability that he brings for Barzal and Eberle, but just kind of the wild card, you know, whistle to whistle stuff that he's going to bring. You know, the Islanders have a lot of big, heavy guys, but they don't have a lot of agitators. And I obviously, you know, if you've been paying attention to hockey in this last week, you know, the Caps have,
yeah,
plenty of guys who can do that and also back it up with their fists and their size. The Penguins are pretty, you know, have some agitators, and really, you know, the Penguins' two big stars and Malkin and Crosby can handle themselves too when it comes to that extracurricular stuff. And obviously, if it's the Bruins, Leo and Brad Marchand have a nice long history dating back to the Leafs Bruins series when Leo was a part of that. So yeah, Leo's going to play a big role, which is something I wouldn't have caught myself saying a few months ago. But I think I've come around to Barry's way of thinking on him. That
I can see Twitter now blowing up right now.
Yeah.
We're past that with Twitter. I think every Islander fan, even the most unhappy Islander fan, is going to embrace Leo when it comes to the playoffs. And frankly, you know, outside of maybe games in January when the team wasn't going well, Komarov's had a pretty good year.
Yeah, he has.
You know, I think he's the consistency part, day in and day out, is what's been missing, and certainly effort is never a problem with him. Physicality is never a problem with him. So yeah, you know, I think if anything, these, you know, the lineup shuffles and the line shuffles with Barzal has shown that in the absence of Lee, Leo's the guy to be on his left side, and I don't think you're going to want to mess with that.
Yeah, no, I also agree with you on Kyle Palmieri as being the X factor, but I got two others as groups. The Cizikas line has got to play back to what's expected of them. You know, that cliched identity setting line in the playoffs, and I think they will, you know, based on what they gave last season in the playoffs. But also, more importantly, I think that Nick Leddy, Scott Mayfield defensive pairing really has to tighten up in the playoffs. And I'm not 100% sure that they can.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I think Andrew, you're not a big data guy, but I think if you just look at the underlying numbers all season long, they've been consistently struggling. You know, I think there was a time there at the beginning of the year where the Islanders were kind of outscoring their issues with them on the ice. But even just watching all the games as you and I have, when the Islanders get into trouble in their own end, when things turn into very non-Islander-like play where the other team is controlling the puck and getting into dangerous areas and maybe getting more than one chance at a time, it's usually with Leddy and Mayfield on the ice.
It was last night. Yeah.
Well, yes. And, you know, I think a lot of the fans put a lot of the blame on Scott Mayfield. But I think it's at this point, after this many weeks and months, it's kind of an equal share for those two guys. It's, you know, Nick Leddy's the more senior guy. He's a guy who's, you know, had to change his style since Trotz came in to be more of an effective player at both ends of the ice. And I think it's incumbent more on him to make that pairing work. You know, Scott Mayfield, much like Leo Komarov, is pretty predictable. You know, he's not the greatest skater. He's a big guy who likes to, you know, be physical in his own end. And if you're Nick Leddy, you know, it worked very well with Devon Taves, and he figured out how to kind of maximize that pairing last year. And they were among the Islanders' best pairings last year. And this year it's been a big drop off. And again, to note with Washington and Pittsburgh, both of them have two dangerous lines, you know, and so you're going to need that Leddy Mayfield pairing to pick up some heavy minutes. And when they're on the road, you're going to even pick up heavier minutes because they're going to want to get that matchup. So, yeah, I agree with you there that those guys need to be a lot better than they've been, not just recently, but the whole season.
Thank you for that, Arthur. And, you know, we could probably sit here talking with you all day long about this. My producer is in our ear saying that we've got to get to our loyal fans who are calling in. So we very much appreciate you taking the time to be part of this roundtable. Ladies and gentlemen, please make sure to check out The Athletic and make sure to follow Arthur on there. It's Arthur Staple. You can follow him on Twitter. He doesn't really use Instagram too much. And, you know, just please go follow him and, of course, follow Andrew on Twitter and at Newsday, as they really do provide some top-of-line Islander content.
See you, Arthur.
Thanks a lot, guys. Anytime.
You're welcome. All right, ladies and gentlemen, as I was just alluding to, we are going to move to our loyal fan caller. His name's Anthony, and he's coming to us from Brooklyn, which is where I usually do this show from, and we're going to get a sports hot take from him. So, hey, Anthony, how are you doing today?
Hey, Matt, I'm doing well. And yourself?
Good. It's obviously Matt, and I'm joined here by co-host Andrew Gross for our show here today. Anthony, what is your sports hot take?
So, I think this is a good opportunity to talk about the Giants draft. I mean, I think this is the first time in probably 3 or 4, maybe 5 years that us Giant fans are actually excited about the season. I think the draft actually increases the excitement for that. I've always felt the draft is not an opportunity to add to fill your team needs, but more so to draft the best player available and add the most value. And I think the Giants did exactly that. They had an opportunity to draft to increase in very important draft capital for 2022, which many front office executives believe is going to be a much stronger class. Due to the NCAA ruling around the COVID-19 season, they granted players an extra year of eligibility. So they think that next year's class will be a little bit deeper. You'll have an opportunity to meet with the players at the combine, which they didn't have this year. So I think adding an extra pick was incredibly valuable, and they added a player, Kadarius Toney, who I think is very elusive. I'm not confident our offensive coordinator will know how to use him, but he has a unique skill set. And adding a very talented defensive end in round 2. So although I think the Giants improved themselves in the draft, I think that they did not improve the offensive line, which if you look around the team, the depth is incredibly strong everywhere. The only real limitation is the offensive line. So I think this is a good opportunity to say one of two things, that I think it was a strong draft. They improved, but they neglected the most glaring need, and I think I'll throw it back to you guys at this point.
All right, and thank you, Anthony, for, you know, bringing that up, and we appreciate you giving time and calling us in here today. We'll obviously be keep an eye on what's going to go on with the Giants as they head into the summer, and you never know who might get picked up on the waiver wire. But we definitely encourage you to, you know, continue listening to the show. We might have some surprise answers for you as we get closer to training camp. And, you know, we thank you very much for being a loyal listener.
Yeah, thanks a lot for the time, guys. I appreciate all you're doing, and keep up the great work.
Thank you. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are at that time where we are out of time, unfortunately. I know we can sit here talking sports all day. Andrew, you've been a heck of a fill-in co-host, and fans are agreeing unanimously. I think you've wally-pipped Daniel and Walt, but you know, that negative thing never came. So we'll have to see if the network chooses to renew their contracts or not.
You know where you screwed up? You never asked me to sing. Because you would have never had me on again.
Well, it's a good thing that you're warning us about that now. Ladies and gentlemen, if you did not catch our live show, please feel free to tune in on the NewYorkExtra.com, Spotify, Podomatic, iTunes, and Apple Podcasts, and SoundCloud. And you can tune in next Friday, May 14th at 4 p.m. for more hot and cold sports takes. Once again, I'm Matthew Butner. To my right is our special guest co-host, Andrew Gross, who gets 10 out of 10 today, saying thank you for tuning in. And if you enjoyed our theme song written by Jessica Page DeMary, please visit her website, jdcompositions.com, for her full works. And we'll see you next time on Outside the Studio.